Clean Drive. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. All manner of persons having anything to bring before the honorable justices of the Supreme Court of the State of Delaware will now draw near and give their attendance. The court is now open. God save the state and the honorable court.
Good morning. The court is ready to hear argument in Honeywell International versus Air Products. Mr. Lazarus?
Good morning, Your Honors. Louis Lazarus on behalf of Air Products and Chemicals, Inc. I wanted to introduce to the court to who is sitting at council table, Tim Cullen and Dick Saylor, who are part of the trial team and are part of Jones Day.
And good morning. Welcome.
Morning.
Morning.
On behalf of Honeywell, I'd like to introduce Jonathan Putnam from Kirkland & Ellis. Also with us at the council table is Leanne Stevenson from Kirkland & Ellis. Mr. Putnam will present the argument on behalf of Honeywell.
Good morning. Welcome to the court.
Good morning. Thank you, Your Honor.
I'm going to start the clock, and you'll see that you have 20 minutes of total time, and it'll count down. When the yellow light comes on, you'll be into the time you reserved, and you can continue, but you will be using your rebuttal time.
I understand that, Your Honor. Thank you.
You're welcome.
May it please the court, this case involves a critical legal principle of contract law. When your contracting party breaches its contractual obligations, you are entitled to a damages remedy that restores you to the position you would have occupied but for the breach. In this case, Honeywell and Air Products signed in 1998 a 10-year strategic alliance agreement. The contract imposed burdens on both parties, including that Honeywell agreed to sell wet process chemicals used for the semiconductor manufacturing, to Air Products, and that Air Products buy exclusively from Honeywell its total requirements of wet process chemical products for sale to a broad group of customers. They buy those exclusively from Honeywell. The parties performed for 5 years, made tens of millions of dollars of sales together, had year-over-year growth of 30-40% a year. But in 2003, approximately halfway into the 10-year term, Air Products decided that it wanted to go a different direction. It decided that it wanted, in the words of a senior executive at Air Products, to blow up the relationship with Honeywell and to acquire the wet process chemical business of Ashland Chemical, which was one of Honeywell's direct competitors and indeed was the largest manufacturer of wet process chemicals in the world. Air Products went ahead and purchased Ashland Chemical's business, and after that, proceeded to run its business in disregard of its contractual obligations, sourcing from its new Ashland business the chemicals that it had agreed to purchase exclusively from Honeywell. Vice Chancellor Strine of the Court of Chancery, after a 5-day trial, found that Air Products had breached its contractual obligations to Honeywell by turning, I'm quoting the language of the opinion of page 2 now, breached its contractual obligations to Honeywell by turning its back on its duty to buy all of its requirements for sales within the scope of the alliance from Honeywell. But in ordering the damages remedy to Honeywell, the Vice Chancellor failed to restore Honeywell to the position it would have occupied but for the breach. The court below did so based on two erroneous rulings of law that limited the breadth and the length of Honeywell's lost profits damages. The result is that Honeywell stands far worse off than it would have been but for Air Products' breach. It's a result that we submit is contrary to contract law principles. This contract is governed by New York contract law, but I'm not sure that anything turns on that particular detail. And we urge the court to remand the case back to the Court of Chancery with instructions to provide Honeywell a full damages remedy that complies with the legal standard.
Well, he limited the damages to 2 years based on the termination notice.
That's right.
And I assume that's one of the alleged errors. What's the other alleged error?
thank you, Your Honor. The other alleged error was the court's refusal to award half of Honeywell's lost profits claim, the half that related to the sales made by the former Ashland business. Air Products, after acquiring Ashland, had effectively two businesses, the original Air Products business and then an Ashland business, all part of Air Products, the company that was and remained bound by the contract. But for Air Products' breach, they would have obtained all of those wet process chemicals from Honeywell, that is, this chemicals for sale by either of their two divisions.
But am I correct in understanding his ruling that the damages for 2 years would be based on whatever the custom was up until that time with regard to customers and products?
Well, that's right. He made two decisions. He found in terms of what the scope of the contract was, that the contract included the customers who had actually purchased from the parties working together for 5 years and included the products, that is, you know, these are sulfuric acid, hydrogen peroxide, series of chemicals, that it would also include the products that were actually sold by the parties. So that was his finding on liability, and neither side disputes the finding that those were the customers that were covered and those were the products that were covered. But when he turned to damages based on what we submit are two erroneous, his misinterpretation of two erroneous legal principles, he limited Honeywell's damages remedy. And it's important to understand that the chemicals that Air Products sold after the acquisition were precisely the same chemicals to the precisely the same customers that they had exclusively obtained from Honeywell prior to the acquisition.
In making this ruling, he relied on the comment to the UCC that you thought was erroneous.
We thought that the comment, his interpretation of the comment was erroneous. We frankly thought that the UCC provision just didn't apply. As the court knows from the papers, Air Products actually cites a different comment from the same provision. But whatever comment you're citing, they are both comments to 2306 of the UCC. What that talks about is the ability of the requirements, that comment talks about protection for the requirements seller, that is here Honeywell, from the ability of the requirements buyer to raise or lower its demands. In other words, when you have a requirements contract, you as the seller agree to sell to their requirements. And since the other party effectively is controlling the demand, you've got to be careful that it doesn't increase or decrease the demand too high and too much to the detriment of the requirements seller. But that provision of the UCC just does not apply at all, and no party, Air Products hasn't cited anything, the Chancery Court didn't cite anything, no party has ever found, and we believe no case has ever found, that provision to limit the requirements buyer's obligations. That is, there are circumstances where 2306 of the UCC has been applied to protect the requirements seller if the requirements buyer were all of a sudden to demand a lot less or a lot more of its product. But we're not aware of any case where 2306 has been applied to limit the obligations of the requirements buyer here at Products, where the seller stands ready, willing, and able to continue to fulfill its obligations.
But is it the case that after the Ashland wet chemicals business was acquired, that all of the requirements therefore had been purchased or would have been purchased from Honeywell were purchased from Ashland and then sold directly by Air Products to its customers?
Partially, Your Honor. What Air Products did was for the business, the division of Air Products that was the old Air Products, they continued through the trial to buy from Honeywell. But for the division that was the old Ashland, now a subsidiary or a portion of not Air Products, they sold their own chemicals. They didn't buy them from Honeywell for the same customers for the same products. There's an example in the brief. There are hundreds of examples in the record. There's a Motorola facility in Phoenix called Motorola MOS, M-O-S-12, one of the largest semiconductor manufacturing facilities in the country. In the 12 months before the acquisition, Air Products sold $400,000 worth of sulfuric acid that it obtained from Honeywell to that facility. in the 4 months after the acquisition, Air Products sold sulfuric acid to the same facility. So same chemical, same customer, same physical plant, but this time was obtaining that sulfuric acid internally from its new Ashland division.
Your point, though, is that Honeywell did not lose sales of requirements to the alliance, but rather was precluded from gaining additional sales. Is that correct?
Well, we lost sales that we would have made had they complied with the contract.
No. Was there a net decrease from the level of sales that existed the moment before the acquisition, or is your argument that there was simply a preclusion from experiencing an increase?
The latter, Your Honor. That is...
All right. And is it the case that the sole basis for the Vice Chancellor's ruling was that the law did not require including any transactions stemming from the acquisition of the new company?
Well, I don't
think were there factual reasons as well for the Vice Chancellor's ruling?
No, there were two legal rulings, no factual rulings, two legal rulings that were related to the acquisition, although I don't know that they turned on the acquisition. He first cited the section of the UCC that, as I've just tried to illustrate and we talked about in the briefs, doesn't apply. He then talks about the legal concept of foreseeability. Again, a well-recognized, important, where it applies legal concept. What the concept of foreseeability says is the parties, either at the time of contracting or the time of breach, have to have foreseen that harm would result if there was a breach. But it does not say that the parties had to foresee the particular breach that occurs. It's clear if you look at the New York cases, if you look at, for example, late Professor Farnsworth's treatise, what he says is, what must be foreseeable is that loss would result if the breach occurred. There's no requirement that the breach itself or the particular way the loss came about.
But there was no loss here.
Sorry?
There was no loss here, at least not in the sense of a net loss.
Well, but Your Honor, I'd submit that in a lost profits case or in a damages case, contract case, you've got to compare where the plaintiff would have been had the defendant complied with the contract, performed the contract, to where the plaintiff was in the actual world. That's comparing the but-for world to the actual world. And making that comparison, there absolutely was a loss because we were precluded.
That was a failure to gain an increase as a result of the acquisition, but not a net loss of the status quo as it existed before the acquisition.
I agree with that statement, Your Honor. We did.
Well, I thought your position is that when you sign a 10-year agreement, it clearly contemplated over the course of a decade you may rearrange the composition of your business or do other things, but whatever you do, you've got this agreement that stays in place for 10 years and you have to deal with us for 10 years.
That's right, and a requirements contract inherently has upside and downside risk. That is, when we agreed to sell their requirements, we didn't know off the bat they may be zero, they may be $100 million.
What is truly our total requirements contract?
For the products and the customers covered, yes, Your Honor.
All right, so how was determined on, supposed to be determined on a year-to-year basis?
That's right. Well, there was an original list, and then the parties agreed in the contract to revisit it to as the conduct evolved.
And that has to be by mutual agreement.
It does, Your Honor.
So if there had been a conference about ECD customers, your opponent could have said no deal.
Well, but, Your Honor, we're focusing on the exact same customers, Motorola MOS 12. The parties agreed to sell to Motorola MOS 12. They had made several million dollars worth of sales per year to Motorola MOS 12. Parties agreed that that was a customer. Parties agreed that sulfuric acid was a product. We were selling sulfuric acid to them. They were selling it to Motorola MOS 12. So the parties had come to an agreement on that. But after the acquisition of Ashland, Air Products start selling its own sulfuric acid to Motorola MOS 12. And again, there are hundreds of other examples, but just take that as an example. Instead of, as they were required to, and as they had agreed to, selling our sulfuric acid.
So is the scope of the alliance, the phrase that you initially quoted from the Vice Chancellor, is that, and deciding what that is that a mixed question of law and fact?
I think the question of what the party's conduct was is a question of fact. The question of how that conduct impacts the contract as it exists, the alliance as it exists, is probably viewed as a mixed question of law and fact.
Here's your rebuttal time.
If I could just briefly address the termination issue that Your Honor raised, and then I'll save the balance of my time. Contract was had a 10-year initial term, was terminable under certain specific conditions. Section 2C of the contract is the provision that the Chancery Court cited, and it talks about a formula comparing the sales made by the alliance to the sales made by Honeywell when it was selling direct to the market. That formula incorporates the defined terms of capital P products and capital C customers. The Court of Chancery, as the discussion illustrated, found that the list of products and customers had been modified by the contract. Parties had agreed Motorola must 12 sulfuric acid and lots of other examples. That's a covered product, a covered customer. But the Court of Chancery proceeded not to apply that termination provision as written. That is, termination provision says you look at the percentage of our direct sales compared to the alliance sales of products to customers. Now, there's a little bit of a two ships passing in the night, I think, between the parties' briefs on this issue. They say we haven't proven that the termination provision changed. We say that they haven't proven that the termination provision changed. One thing both sides agree is the termination provision hasn't changed and you need to interpret it and enforce it as written. That's not what the Vice Chancellor did. The Vice Chancellor did not apply his list of products and customers to the termination provision, and it was undisputed at trial that if you interpreted or applied the formula based on the list of products and customers that the Vice Chancellor found, the sales threshold had not been exceeded, and therefore there was no right to terminate. That should have resulted in the contract not being allowed to be terminated early, lasting to 2008, and therefore our lost profits damages, whatever their scope, that is, whether they were just for the historic Air Products business or also for the Ashland business, those damages should have extended to 2008. If the court doesn't have any questions on that, I'll save the balance of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors.
Good morning.
May it please the Court, Louis Lazarus on behalf of Air Products and Chemicals, Inc. I will speak to both the cross-appeal and the appeal and would like to reserve 1 minute for rebuttal. I would like to start with an overview to put the issues into context. By 2003, the strategic alliance was failing. The parties could not agree on who would be treated as customers within the scope of the alliance. The parties were simply muddling through, acting on an impromptu, informal, ad hoc basis as to whether to make particular sales, with nothing in their agreement that provided a methodology to break a deadlock regarding who should be within the scope of the alliance, and nothing in the agreement that bound the parties to an extrinsic objective standard or condition from which to resolve a disagreement as to scope. It was in that context that the opportunity to acquire Ashland arose. Ashland had four divisions. Air Products would have been happy to acquire only three, excluding the wet process chemicals, but Ashland insisted that the company would be sold only as a package. And when that happened, Air Products went to Honeywell and invited it to participate in the investment. Honeywell declined.
Is that relevant legally?
Is that relevant legally? It's relevant to the fact that they are trying to get damages, as Your Honor noted, for additional customers, not for, as Justice Holland noted, the customers that were actually, the court found, within the scope of the alliance on August the 29th, 2003, when Air Products gave its notice of termination. But I do think it shows the overreaching on Honeywell's part that they are coming to this court asking it to reverse the carefully considered findings of the court below based on factual findings on a mixed question of law and fact with respect to the scope of the contract, and asking it to award, in effect, windfall damages for an investment that declined to participate.
Windfall only in the sense that Honeywell features that are acquired with Ashland?
Absolutely. We could have participated. That's correct, sir.
Is that relevant?
Again, it goes to the... They are making an argument that it is somehow... it would be... Context of fact, Air Products went to Honeywell, offered it the opportunity to participate in the investment in Ashland, and it declined. There is nothing in the agreement, Your Honor, that gives Honeywell a call on the capital of Air Products. Air Products made this decision. It acquired Ashland. Honeywell declined to participate in that investment. Those customers were not customers. Those customers of Ashland were not customers that had been achieved through the alliance. They were customers that Ashland had achieved. They were not customers that the parties had achieved jointly through their cooperative efforts in the strategic alliance. But I would say that the fundamental point that Air Products acquired $295 million is not, strictly speaking, relevant to the alliance.
Well, isn't it a fact that some of the customers of Ashland were also customers of the alliance because a number of these customers were buying from dual sources?
Correct. And what that shows is that it's a false argument to say that those customers of Ashland automatically would have become customers of the alliance or could have become customers of the alliance. I mean, the customers of Ashland made their own decision to buy, in some cases, as Your Honor correctly points out, from both Honeywell through the alliance and from Ashland. And so to now say that somehow they're entitled to damages for sales made where the customer makes a choice and has continually made a choice, as Your Honor correctly notes, to purchase sometimes from Ashland and sometimes from Honeywell is overreaching.
Well, let's use Motorola as an example and tell the court why what happened with Motorola was completely proper.
What happened with Motorola was that pending the decision of this court, Air Products continued to service that product, which had been qualified through Honeywell for sulfuric acid through the alliance to Motorola. It also continued, as the customer had desired, to purchase to supply chemicals through Ashland. That was a choice of the customer, and that's exactly what happened with respect to that example that Your Honor asked about. Let me turn directly to my argument. I want to make 3 points today. The first one is on the cross appeal that the strategic alliance agreement is unenforceable as a matter of New York law. And on that ground, the judgment of the court below should be reversed and an order entered directing Honeywell to return the amount paid by Air Products to satisfy the judgment.
Is your argument based on the contract as written? That
yes.
Was it ab initio?
That is exactly our argument, Your Honor. It is based on the contract as written. My second point will be that if the court disagrees, the trial court correctly determined the termination period as being 2 years. And third, the trial court correctly determined the scope of the agreement and the damages, and its judgment should be affirmed in all respects.
And tell us what's happened with regard to payment of the judgment. Is there an outstanding judgment now?
The judgment has been paid in full. Both parties in the final order reserve their rights with respect to this appeal. Your Honor, to respond to Justice Jacobs about why this contract is void ab initio, and it is void ab initio as a matter of law because in this case, the party's desire for flexibility overwhelmed the lawyer's ability to draft an enforceable agreement. New York law is clear that a contract is unenforceable where it fails to permit a court to determine with reasonable certainty its terms. Here, the party's written agreement required the parties, as Justice Ridgely noted, at least once a year to review and modify the lists of products and customers appended to the contract as Exhibits A and B, and which could not be modified except in writing. It was these certain products and certain customers which comprised the scope of the alliance. In other words, a customer was not within the alliance, except as agreed, Your Honor correctly noted, except as agreed by the parties, but with no methodology and no reference to an extrinsic objective standard or condition within the agreement to resolve disagreements. And that is why the agreement is unenforceable. Honeywell's sole fact witness at trial, Paul Raymond, testified himself that who was in the alliance depended upon a series of never-ending negotiations and that there was neither a methodology within the four corners of the document nor reference to an agreed-upon objective standard or decision to make, to decision-maker to break a deadlock.
And that is why Mr. Raymond asked the court, and I'm quoting, to help the parties come to an agreement.
Now,
that's a D81.
It appears that Vice Chancellor Strine said, I'm going to look at the course of conduct, and to the extent I see customers and products and payments being made pursuant to the strategic alliance agreement, they're going to be deemed to be customers and products.
Your Honor, that is correct, that that's what Vice Chancellor Strine said. We would submit that he erred in that judgment for the reason that the historic alliance customers that had been achieved as of the date of the notice of termination, there was no way in the structure of this contract as drafted ab initio that would allow the court to make a prediction about who would be within the scope of the agreement going forward. Each party had the right going forward and the duty under this contract on at least an annual basis as written to come to each other. We don't agree that so-and-so ought to be within the scope of the alliance. And therefore, this agreement was fatally flawed. There was no ability to determine with any degree of reasonable certainty the most material term of this agreement, which is its scope. Now, if Your Honors disagree with that analysis, then you ought to uphold the decision as drafted. And let me start with Honeywell's efforts to overcome the court's finding that the party's course of conduct did not modify Air Products' termination rights, and therefore Air Products' two-year termination notice, which Justice Holland asked about, on August 29, 2003, was valid. Under New York law, a party seeking to claim a written modification of a written contract provision has a heavy burden where the contract forbids modification except in writing. That is so because any lesser burden would create the risk that the court would be denying rights to which the parties manifested agreement in their writing. Thus, where a party seeks to claim a modification by conduct, that party, here Honeywell, must prove that the conduct is unequivocally referable to the claimed modification.
As I understand Mr. Putnam's argument, he acknowledges there was no written modification. And his argument appears to be that if we look at the termination, we have P and C, and that if you just enforce the agreement the way it was written, based on the findings of Vice Chancellor Strine, that P and C changed by course of conduct, then you continue to look at the percentage to see whether Honeywell's gone over or not.
That you have correctly stated Mr. Putnam's position, but it is incorrect for the following reason. The court made a specific finding that there was no evidence that the parties had agreed or that Air Products had agreed to waive its bargain for termination right under Section 2C, which permitted it to exit the alliance on 2 years' notice if Honeywell's direct sales exceeded by more than 10, possibly 20%, the sales through the alliance. But he also made a factual finding, did the court below, that the parties' own conduct demonstrated that the parties understood that customers could have one meaning for one section of the agreement and another for a different section of the agreement. And that is discussed at page 46 of our answering brief and at pages 35 to 40 of the court's opinion. And I would direct the court to B134 and B135 of our appendix. What you had there is a signed writing by Mr. Favier of Honeywell asking that for certain customers that they had just acquired, they be exempt from all provisions of the strategic alliance agreement. That's not the agreement that Air Products signed. Instead, Air Products signed an agreement where it was only exempted Honeywell from paragraph 1C. So you have a situation where not only is there no evidence of an intent to modify Air Products' termination rights, but there's affirmative evidence from the party's course of conduct, a factual finding to which this court ought to defer where it's supported by the record, that they understood that the customer could have one meaning for one section and a different meaning for another.
Let me ask you a hypothetical. Assume there's no change at all in the termination part of the contract. But let's assume in my hypothetical that they actually did write something down that's the equivalent of what we see as the course of conduct, so that in year 3, 4, 5, whatever it is, we have a new list, a new exhibit with customers and products. Would you agree that this new written list signed by both parties of customers and products would constitute P and C for for purposes of the termination agreement?
It would depend on how the party, what the party said in drafting that agreement.
No, they just say, here's the new list of customers, here's the new list of products, and they both sign it. Because that's what was contemplated. Every year they would do that, but they just never did it.
Well, that you are absolutely correct, Your Honor, that they deviated from the written terms of the agreement. They deviated from the requirement to come to terms on a written list. And so, therefore, they never modified in writing the requirement with respect to what would be the base that you look at for determining the 2C obligation.
I agree, and that's why I'm calling it a hypothetical.
Yes, and
I'm saying if they did this every year without ever changing the termination provision, would they have looked at what they signed every year to figure out what P and C were for purposes of termination percentages?
And what I am telling Your Honor in that hypothetical is that Air Products would have been extraordinarily careful not to allow any modification of its termination rights to be vitiated so that they would be put in the, or eviscerated. I don't think Air Products would have ever signed such an agreement that said, here's products, here's customers, and by the way, we'll use that same definition so we virtually it's impossible for us to exit, notwithstanding the fact that Honeywell is directly selling 8 times more to the market than it is through us. So Air Products would, in that hypothetical, I appreciate the Honor's hypothetical, but I will tell you that on this record, and based on the facts found by the Vice Chancellor, Air Products never would have signed an agreement that had that effect.
Well, that seems to support your argument that this agreement was destined never to work from the beginning, because if you're going to fix the percentage for termination to the original list, and then you're going to contemplate an increase in customers and products, but you're going to always multiply the percentage times the original list, after a few years, there clearly would have been a breach as things got more successful, wouldn't there?
I would have to think about that in terms of the arithmetic, Your Honor, so I'm not sure of the answer to Your Honor's question. And maybe on by rebuttal, I'm not sure of the answer arithmetically. Let me turn to the next argument, which is that the trial court correctly determined the scope of the contract, and that is a factual finding. The trial court listened to the live testimony from 7 fact witnesses, one of them from Honeywell and 6 from Air Products, and determined that the scope of the party's agreement was limited by the party's course of performance to the sales actually made by the alliance through the party's cooperative efforts and did not include future sales to customers of Ashland. Honeywell's argument ignores these factual findings of the court, to which this court must defer, where the findings are supported by the record where they are here. Honeywell is in an odd position.
This isn't a mixed question of fact and law.
It is a mixed question of fact and law, but the factual findings as to the scope and that he made as to how the parties determined who was in the scope, but those are factual findings. Those are entitled to deference, and the legal conclusion that follows is that the scope is as he found it. And so the facts, they don't contest the facts. They say in their briefing they make no challenge to the factual findings of the court. And yet a major factual finding of the court is what was the scope of the party's agreement? What was the scope of the requirement and obligation based on the course of performance? That was a factual
finding. Let me ask you a different hypothetical. Let's suppose that the increased volume of business that resulted from the Ashland acquisition had taken place not through an acquisition, but simply by internal growth. What would be your position in that event?
My position would be that if the record showed that Air Products and Honeywell had agreed that they would make sales through the alliance to particular customers, and as a result of that discussion and agreement, they made such sales through the alliance, then it would be within the scope of the agreement. I think that's consistent with what Vice Chancellor Stein has to know. But that's not what happened. In fact, the scope of the alliance is restricted.
The answer to my question is yes, if all of that growth had been internal, as opposed to having occurred as a result of the Ashland acquisition, that issue would have dropped out of the case.
My answer is that it was only when you say internal, not for exactly what you're on. If they have internal...
By, I guess, both parties to the alliance
using their very best efforts to increase sales.
Yes, and if that were to occur and there was a sale, and then you'd have reliable evidence that they had agreed and it was within the scope of the order.
So what we're really talking about here is an increment of growth due to an acquisition rather than internal.
That is correct.
That's the linchpin.
That is correct. And the court made a factual finding that that increment of growth, those Ashland customers were not within the scope of the alliance. The future
but
sales
based on what? Based on language of the contract? Based on testimony?
Based
the party?
On,
based on what?
Stated based on group review of the party's course of performance, in which, and live testimony from witnesses at trial, including Carl Raymond of Honeywell, who said that a customer could not be a customer unless the parties agreed. There was never any agreement that the Ashland customers would be within the scope of this alliance.
Was their testimony addressed, not Ashland specifically, but what would happen if the volume of business increases as a result of an acquisition of additional assets and third parties?
There was.
In other words, was the Ashland problem considered generic?
The termination provision. The parties chose to use defined terms, as the Your Honor's question suggests. They used capital P and capital C. The parties could have, I suppose, written the termination provision differently. They could have written it to say, if the sales to the original list of customers on Exhibit B and the sales of original list of products on Exhibit C changes, or you know, you compare those original lists and the percentages. That's not what they chose to do. They chose to use a defined term. They chose to link the termination right to a concept that they knew would evolve over time. Mr. Lazarus says, oh, we never would have given away our termination rights like that. they enter into a contract that specifically links their termination rights to a moving target. Now, whether that was wise or not is not, you know, the issue for this court, but there's certainly no reason to relieve them of that choice. His cross appeal just turns into an issue of quantification of damages with all respect. These are two sophisticated multi-billion-dollar companies. They sign a 40-page contract negotiated for months. They perform under it for 5 years. Even after the litigation starts, Air Products sends letters to us and sends letters to the customers saying, we have this existing ongoing contract with Honeywell. It's not until the day their counterclaims are due in the final phase of the litigation below that they, for the first time, assert not only is the contract invalid, it's never been valid. It's just not a plausible argument, especially because, as Vice Chancellor Strine found, the contract provides an extrinsic standard. The contract says in Section 1A, you look at the conduct of the parties to determine the scope of the alliance, and that's exactly what Vice Chancellor Strine did. If on remand they want to argue that certain sales might not have been made in the future, certain customers might not be customers in the future, that's a factual issue that would they would be allowed to argue as to our quantification of damages on remand. It's not a reason not to enforce the contract. Thank you.
We want to observe, Your Honors, that Mr. Putnam noted that whether or not who are the customers and who are the products is a factual issue. The court considered all this evidence and made a factual determination as to who was within the scope of the alliance. And they're arguing to overturn that factual determination, which is based on the record. With respect to the termination rights, Air Products was concerned that it be the primary face to the market. The reason I answered Your Honor's hypothetical the way I did, that Air Products would never have agreed to the modification that Your Honor describes, is that would have eviscerated our right to get out of this alliance, notwithstanding the fact that Honeywell was no longer making us the direct primary face to the market. I have nothing further to
add. Thank you. Thank you both. The court will take this matter under advisement and also take a brief recess.
Please rise.